Welcome to As We Speak. Today you will hear the second and final part of host David Sanborn's conversation with author and musician James McBride.
If you've been on enough journeys, you realize that it doesn't matter what bus you've ridden on, as long as you got there, this piece. I mean, Johnny Mandel, the Ranger. I remember riding an elevator with him, and I'm telling you, we got on at the sixth floor, and by the first floor, I felt like I had an understanding of life, man. He just had that thing in him. He's got that, he had that thing, man, that indefinable thing, that quality of music has made me full. And you have that. And Sun has that.
Music I spent a lot of time with Johnny.
He's the
greatest.
Yeah. Oh my God, man. I'm glad his name has come up, because when you talk about someone, they're alive. I never worked with him, but you know, he was obviously you did, right?
I mean, did an album with him called Pearls. And
did he do all the arrangements?
He did all the arrangements, yeah. Yeah.
What was he like?
He was great. I mean, he talked a lot about the old days. He talked a lot about, because he was a trombone player, and he was like,
that's right,
you know, a touring musician.
Yeah, that's
so,
right.
And he just had so much, I don't know, there was just a kind of calm. He was an odd guy in some ways.
Right. He was an eccentric. He was an eccentric person.
Definitely an eccentric. He had an interesting hairpiece that kind of, one of those things that kind of didn't quite fit right, looked like a helmet a little bit. Oh, I didn't realize you were wearing a hairpiece. I for one was fooled.
He was on the ASCAP board. I was on the I'm on the foundation, and that's where I met him. And we were talking about some things, and he played with Basie for a while, and Billy Byers, they were all his.
Yeah,
Oliver Nelson, these cats were his compadres, and he really had an understanding of the world. He just had that.
Yeah,
but you know, you asked me about writers, and I think that if you're a writer, you're like a musician in the sense that you are trying to find a peaceful place to sit in a world where there is so little peace. Yeah. And if you find a play, I find it in humor. I know when I met Kurt Vonnegut, and I had lunch with him a couple of times, he was just an extraordinarily funny guy.
Yeah.
And I would ask him, I'd say, how did you find the voice in this person? How did you? And he said, I just listen to people. I just listen to people, man. There's music in the way they talk. He loved Wagner, by the way. He was a big fan of Wagner.
Dum da da dum 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 dum.
And Louis Armstrong too. He liked Louis Armstrong. Yeah. We would sit in his living room, and I don't even drink, but I just drank because I'm with Kurt Vonnegut. And after about a drink and a half, I was plowed. Man, I was listening to Louis Armstrong and Richard Wagner. I was like, I didn't care. I was like in the presence of a great literary
Kurt Vonnegut.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny that you bring up his name, because the year that I went to Iowa, I transferred from Northwestern, and that's the year I met Wendell. Kurt Vonnegut was the artist in residence for the Iowa Writers Workshop. And there was a housing complex with a lot of old ramshackle houses and lean-tos and, about 20 or 30 residences in this one area. It was more or less the bohemian residences of University of Iowa. And all these, and Kurt Vonnegut was there, living there, and along with a whole lot of other writers and some musicians, mostly writers though. And I remember being around him and talking to him, and just, I think Breakfast of Champions had just come out.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. And I just remember him, kind of holding court and just being like mesmerized. I don't remember much of what he said, but it was just his presence. And, we used to have these like luaus where they'd get a whole big pig and roast it in a pit, you know, and everybody would get completely loaded and just, you know.
Wow, man. I mean, I think the idea of David Sanborn and Kurt Vonnegut talking.
Yeah.
I mean, that's something you thought you'd see in heaven. That's really interesting, man. I mean,
yeah, Nelson Algren had been there a couple, I think the year before. But it was Kurt Vonnegut was, I mean, and I remember reading Breakfast of Champions because I think it had just come out. And I was just like, so like, it just kind of exploded. It was, and it was like, you know, like the, like painters like James Rosenquist or these guys that would write these kind of bizarre, I don't know. It was just fun to read.
Well, it's funny because I have Kurt Vonnegut right on my desk, and I have a guy by the name of Nissan Taleb. I mean, but Kurt Vonnegut's big volume of his work stays right on my desk. And I'm starting to think about a new book, I can't read him anymore. Because once you start, you know, thinking of your own, you don't want to, you know, you don't want anyone else's work to bleed into yours. And I'm old enough now to sort of like, you know, I was reading a lot of John le Carré, who did a lot of
stuff. Yeah.
And with the new book that just came out, you know, has just put me into a new level of like, of just a whole other level of life, you know. And so I started reading John le Carré because he was very successful.
Yeah.
And I wanted to know, like, how do you live with that kind of success?
Yeah.
And it's helped me a little bit. I mean, I don't want to do what he did, but it's when you reach a certain level of literary success, you're isolated, man. You know, you're isolated.
Yeah, because you find that people talk to you in a different way.
Well, first of all, they think you know what you're talking about, which you don't. So there's that, and then you know there's the money. You know, you're suddenly making, you know, big chunks of money, and then that changes your relationship too, because you know you can't call up a cat and say, he's saying, "Well, man, I just got back from Kansas, man. I'm tired, man. Three flights on that. They broke my guitar on the plane." I mean, you have to learn to just speak in the language of people where they are, and not complain about or voice your own concerns about, because you know, as an artist, and you know this, people see you and they say, "Oh, this cat's successful. He has no problems at all."
Yeah.
Meanwhile, record company's suing you. This guy, he wants it. I mean, it's all the stuff that nobody knows about, and you're supposed to be, you know, you're supposed to walk into the room and make magic stuff happen. So I have like all the stuff going on in my life that nobody knows about.
Yeah.
They just see my book in the bookstore and they say, "Oh, it's groovy." But I've learned to turn that stuff off. And, you know, just I have my own little circle of friends that have, you know, they've stayed with Bill Singer being one of them.
Yeah.
That are the same, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, Bill and I are into washing cars. We wash our cars together over the internet. You know, he gives me a car wash shit. You know, Bill was into flashlights for a long time. So I have in my desk.
I remember. Oh, my God. I went through that with him. Hey, you're not going to believe this. This flashlight. It's going to change your life.
Right. I can see the moon. Like, okay.
Yeah.
I
hear it. Wow. And then binoculars and telescopes. There was a period of that.
Well, I mean, I'm into washing cars now. We're into, you know, a whole, but you know, when Bill and I had to leave our place, on 43rd Street, we had a big party. We had a whole bunch of saxophone players, and Roger Rosenblatt, I think, is
Rosenberg.
Rosenberg came.
Lives across the street.
Yeah, lives across the street. A bunch of cats came, and these Broadway cats came, and then the cats who don't do Broadway come. Who would say, you know, I didn't move to New York to do, and you know, these cats got together and they were, we all got plastered. And then some Japanese guy showed up with some, you know, Japan whiskey, 100 years old. And that's all I remember. I don't remember.
It was officer, this is the last thing I remember as I was, you know, He would wake up naked on a park bench with one sock on, and the sock wasn't yours. How the hell did that happen?
Well, that was a great time, but Sonny Rollins gave me a thing one time. I have it on my desk right here. It's called The Golden Rule is Common to All Religions. And, it has everyone like Buddhism, Christianity, Hinduism, Islam, Sikhism, Taoism. And it all basically all is the same, that what's hurtful to yourself, don't do to other people. Everything else is just chatter.
Yeah.
That's really. Yeah. And so, I try to live that way. And I think that it's helped me as a writer to listen to, listen to the people who came before me like you. I mean, you're not that much older than me. I mean, it's just that when we came of age, in our 20s, you were in your 30s, and in our teens, you were in your
20s. Yeah.
But I hope that we are, instrumental in helping the younger people who are behind us, to get ahead and to keep, because we have a lot of work to do as artists, man. We have to keep peace in the way,
Yeah. I believe that. I mean, that's the spiritual side of what we do. It's like, all you can do is just tell the truth, and hopefully the truth will set not only you free, but other people as well. Because if you're true to yourself, I mean, I still have that optimistic belief that people can hear that. That there are people, not everybody's going to hear it.
Right.
But enough people are going to hear it, that it's going to help. Look, music has given me the ability to transform my life. And that's an ongoing process, the process of transformation. I think that humor is a key part of that, because sometimes I look back on shit that I did and I go, God, I can't believe it. But then I can laugh at it and say, I'm just another clown on the bus, just trying to figure stuff out. And that's spirituality. That's beauty. And that's, what my job is.
I think one of the things that you've done in American music that a lot of people don't understand is that yourself, people like Joe Zawinul, Johnny Mandel, the Brecker brothers, is that you laid yourself across the chasm of racism. And just laid down and let people walk over your back so that everyone could get from one side to the next. It's nothing you actually wanted to do. It's just the music was so powerful. You wanted to do it. And so you did it at a time when few white players did it, not because they didn't want to or they did, but it's just because the music led you to the truth. And so it's just something that musicians have a hard time talking about, because it puts a lot of people on the spot. But the second thing is that it's not an easy thing to discuss. I've often wanted to write about it, but how do you write about it? When, how do you say that, Pat Martino in Philadelphia, who was relatively unknown, one of the great jazz guitarists ever. How do you say that, that Jeff Lee Johnson, who was a great guitar player as well.
Great guitar player.
I mean, how do you equivalent? There's no equivalency. They both suffered in a society that did not appreciate either. And so you can't quantify, because the music doesn't care. People care, but the music doesn't care. But what I've appreciated about what cats like yourself have done, at least as a black musician, is that there has always been, the door here is about the truth. And I'm coming in, whether you like it or not. And guess what? He can't get it. Well, he's not about the truth. And so all of you cats, that's not the right metaphor. What I'm saying is that when you made that crossing into black music, you made it because the music picked you up and carried you into the room. Some of these people who do it and I can't think of anyone, but you know, I can, when I see them, I say, oh, these are people who say, well, I'm, you know, my eyes have seen the glow. And you realize they're just bullshit. It's like Ethan Hawke when Ethan Hawke does movies. When Ethan Hawke does movies, you realize the guy's walking in there pure. He's like you in music, you know, you in film, rather. He just walks in there pure with talent. And then boom, when he did The Good Lord Bird,
Oh man.
he
Oh
was.
man. That was so, I'm so glad you brought that up because that's so powerful. Just his eyes. We just saw the pain and confusion and self-doubt. Everything just was in his face, and like
Just
it was
amazing.
funny, it
Yeah.
was moving, it was powerful. Man,
And you know
I.
something, people don't know that he wrote a lot of that. Him and a guy named Mark Richard, a lot of those scripts they rewrote. They tried very hard to stick close to the book.
Yeah, which
And
I think they did. I mean, in my,
absolutely,
you
yeah.
know.
But also that series got made because of Ethan Hawke,
Yes.
because he walked it through, you know. He had to walk it from, you know, it's because it's a long way from a book to TV. He walked it through and he made sure, and he got some of the really good act, Daveed Diggs to play Frederick Douglass. And
Oh man. That the complex the way the complexity that he reflected in his portrayal of Frederick Douglass was so great. That scene where they end up getting drunk together and
right, yeah. And then,
they kind of showed Frederick Douglass's domestic life. And I
Yeah.
mean, that was so it was funny and truthful. And it's like, you know, and it's like, jeez, oh, you know.
Well, I got a lot of heat for writing, you know, in the book, you know, Frederick Douglass is trying to get a little, he's trying to get a little itchy, scratchy, you know, he's trying to get his head. I took
Yeah, but he's a
little
human being.
pills.
That was the thing. It's like, you know, that to me is like, that makes things all the more powerful when you see the human frailty. I don't even want to call it frailty, just the human condition. It's like, that's the truth. You know what I mean? And you get as close to the truth as you can, you
Well, I
know.
mean, the truth is he had a black wife and a white girlfriend. They all lived in the same house. I mean, you know, I'd like two girlfriends to live in the house with me. I mean, my girlfriend wouldn't like it now. I mean, it ain't gonna happen, but you know, I mean, you know, he was a complicated person. He was, you know, Frederick Douglass was a great man, a great statesman. And he decided that he didn't want to go to Harper's Ferry and get killed with John Brown. You know, more power to him. I mean, I don't blame him. Ethan understood that. And he worked those scenes in a way that was just, he really, and he would sit around, he would talk to the other actors and talk to the directors about this stuff. Everything he does is comes with a great deal of sensitivity and a great deal of literary background, you know. Literary knowledge. He's like you, he's a big reader, you know. And he writes too. Do you write books, by the way?
Oh my God, no. I mean, I love it. I have attacks of lyricism verbally, but they're no more than just attacks. You know, and I try to write shit down because I mean, I look back at my life and I say, well, I've had kind of an interesting life. I mean, and a charmed life in a way. And, you know, the fact that music, you know, I took up the saxophone as therapy when I was a little, because I had polio, I was in the hospital for a couple of years. I was in an iron lung for a long period of time. And I got out of the iron lung and I was paralyzed from the neck down. And couldn't walk, and you know, between 3 and 5, and all of a sudden, you know, I start various reasons able to walk again, and then I'm thrown into kindergarten. I was like, okay, everything is all right now. What? You know, it's like being through a firebombing at Dresden, and then so okay, now everything's all right. It's like, you know, Omaha Beach, and then you know, an advertising agency, you know,
Wow.
and you know, and just my. The way that, you know, I was protected by people, other musicians that looked out for me and gave me entree into places, because I just wanted to be around music. You know, I just wanted to be around it. And I ended up being a professional musician because I really wasn't interested in doing anything else. No talent, no interest, no passion for anything.
When
I
you
had
came
no
to New York, how did you come to New York? Did you just come to New York like and just land?
I always wanted to be in New York. My father, that's a long story about my father, but he ended up in the advertising business.
Okay.
And part of what he did was he would have to travel around the country, mostly to New York, for business, but to other advertising agencies. This is like in the mid-50s, 55, 56.
Mm-hmm.
And I just had, New York was a mythological place to me because it was 52nd Street. It was, abstract expressionism. It was the whole post-war reality. America was the center of the world. And New York was the center of the center of the world. Everything was happening in New York. It was like the music, the art, everything. And there was just this intense, passionate life. And I just wanted to be there. I wanted to be there. And so one year in 1956, my parents took my mother and myself to New York. And we went around all these places. I couldn't get into any of the clubs on 52nd Street. But I remember I went to a Broadway play. I saw My Fair Lady with Rex Harrison and Julie Andrews, and I went to, Toots Shores and, went to Sam Goody's record store. And there was like, I said, oh, man, this is it. And I said, this is where I want to be. And I think all my life, I just wanted to be in New York. And I ended up playing with Paul Butterfield.
Yeah.
A series of through this guy, Philip Wilson, who I, a drummer from St. Louis, who had been my mentor, my protector. He got a job with Butterfield, got me a job with Butterfield. And we were living on the road and we ended up in Woodstock, New York, 90 miles from Manhattan. And various other things happened. I was married very young with a small baby. And I was married too young. Finally went down to New York because Howard Johnson, who you know from The Corner,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. The
He did some of the music.
Tuba baritone player.
Yeah, exactly. He brought me down to New York to meet Gil Evans. And he said, oh man, Gil, you got to meet this young alto player. And I met Gil and I played with him. And I said, okay, this is where I got to be. And Gil offered to put me up at his place. He lived down in Westbeth. And so I lived there and, played with Gil. We used to do Monday nights at the Village Vanguard. And I met Miles through Gil.
Wow,
Miles
man.
Used to come. Miles loved Gil. Miles came over and was hanging out, And I remember one night he was there. We used to, Gil used to record all of our Monday nights at the Vanguard. And we were sitting around listening to the tapes, and Miles was there. This tune came on, and I'm sweating bullets because I know a solo of mine is coming up. And I'm going, fuck, man. So Miles Davis is here listening to me. And I played, and I played something on the tape in a solo. And I go, just without thinking, I said, I wish I hadn't played that. And Miles just looked at me and said, you should have played it twice. It took me a long time to figure out what that meant. But what I ended up taking away from that is like, just commit, man. It's just like, turn it into something good.
Yeah, well, if Miles said anything, I mean, I'm sure like he had a good heart. He wasn't he was so misunderstood by people.
Absolutely.
They
He
just,
had a re he had a compassion and a sensitivity that, whatever the facade was, I mean, it didn't matter to me. That was, I mean, for lack of a better word, that was show business.
Right.
That was
Yeah.
Whatever you got to do
Yeah.
to keep yeah. what, whatever, you know, and whatever, you know, experience he had in his life that led, I mean, he played with Charlie Parker when he was 19, you right. know, I mean, he was 19 years old, you
yeah.
know, and like this kid from East St. Louis, he's going down, there's people like Fats Navarro and Clifford Brown there, all these Dizzy Gillespie,
yeah.
and And I asked him about that one time. He said, man, I quit the band every night.
No
said,
kidding.
and Bird just would come and say, come on, man, you got to come back. You got to hang in there. He said, I quit every night because he was so beaten up by, you know, all that, oh, this cat can't play and blah, blah, blah. And you hear the early solos and I mean, he's tentative, but there's Miles is there.
Yeah.
You know? And he developed this whole thing, but the grounding of Charlie Parker's music and the blues of Charlie Parker, you know, because that Kansas City, you could always hear the blues in Charlie Parker, always, you know, and that's what Miles had. That it's that Mississippi River, St. Louis, Memphis, Kansas City thing.
I always felt that in the latter years, since Wynton came to New York. It's been like, if you're not from New Orleans, you know, I mean, and it's no fault of Wynton's, by the way, because he's done a lot. He's done more for jazz.
Oh my God, yes.
Him more him than his brothers, especially Wynton. He's put him, you know, he sacrificed a lot for the music and people, the ways that people don't really know, in my opinion, you know, because he's got to run that band, he's got to raise the money, he's got to do all that stuff. You know, none of us could do it. But there is a little prejudice these days that, in my mind, that if you're not from New Orleans, you know, you didn't come from New Orleans, forget it. I mean, I know so many great cats from Philly, for example, you know, St. Louis and from, you know, Chicago, Baltimore, I mean, Gary Thomas. I mean, there's so many.
Gary Thomas.
I mean, shit, man.
He's a beast.
Oh, man, I heard him play. I was like, man, I'm just quitting. I was in a club in Brooklyn one night when Wallace Roney and Lance Bryant. Lance is a tenor player, and Wallace Roney, of course, the trumpet. And they started playing. And if my friend Wendell Pierce, the actor, was there. And man, Wendell Pierce said, are you going to pull out your horn? I said, man, if you say anything about that horn, right, I'll kill you right now. They were like incredible, man. I mean, and I just, you know, I feel like there's so much of that that people don't know about, you know.
Yeah. I wanted to touch on a couple of other things about the corner, which I found so like loving, and you know, especially that there was that one scene episode where they're in the barbershop community center kind of thing, and they talk about the vice president coming through town, and you know, and everybody's going to get $1,200, you know. And all that, and then it turns out to be a cardboard cutout of Dick Cheney, and just you know, just it was just you know, who's got the plan? The man's got the plan. The plan. Right. What's the plan? The man. The man's got the plan, and it's just like that. That kind of back and forth was just so great. And there was a one of the other little pieces that Jonathan Duckett sent me. There was a little instrumental interlude. It sounded like a second line thing. It was so great with I think it was tuba and clarinet. Who was that clarinet player?
Oh, that was Bill Easley playing clarinet.
Bill Easley, okay.
Bill Easley, wonderful clarinet player. I think Bill Easley was playing clarinet. I was playing tenor. Howard Johnson was playing tuba.
Yeah.
And I don't remember who else is. A guy named Adderley was playing bass. Nate Adderley, I think his name is. Not Nate, but it's Adderley. Conrad Adderley was playing bass. Mm-hmm. And Damon DeWitt was on drums. And Keith Robinson was on guitar. But I got Bill Easley because Bill Easley he can really play the clarinet. He's a great player, man.
Yes,
still
absolutely. Player. Yeah, he's a tenor player, too.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he's a tenor player. And Howard Johnson was just a stroke of luck to get him to show up, you know. Wonderful. I mean, wow, man. I was sitting there, I was saying to myself, my heart was beating fast because I had to be the host of the show. That whole show was because PRI at the time was looking for a substitute show for, I forgot this guy, you know, the Lutheran people, you know, I forgot this guy's name, but he was a host of the shows. It was a show that everyone liked. It was called Prairie Home Companion. They were looking for
Garrison Keillor.
Garrison Keillor. They were looking for a show. They asked me if I wanted to do you know, like the something like the Prairie Home Companion. I said, well, yeah, let me do the corner. And I did it and they didn't like it. So that's why the corner died. You know, that was just, and I didn't have a lot of money to put that together either. But I managed to put together and, you know, slap it all together. And one of my many failures, but, you know,
They didn't like it.
They didn't like it. No, they didn't like it. I thought it was really funny.
I thought it was hilarious.
Well, if I'd had money, I'd have, you know, I'd had a real arranger to do the arrangements and stuff. I didn't have any money to do that stuff. I just managed to, you know, I thought it was good too, but they didn't like it. It was ahead of its time, you know, I guess.
Well, yeah, because, well, I don't know. I don't know what to say about that other than I just enjoyed it. And it made me laugh. Made me laugh out loud
Well,
when I listened to it.
It was supposed to be about, you know, life on a in a neighborhood, you know, in the 60s, where, you know, or 60s or 70s, where all this stuff was happening in the barbershop. I had really good characters like Miss Kim, and who owned the
school.
I thought the action
she's
was
Korean.
Miss
She's Korean.
Korean. Yeah.
Not
right.
not Chinese. I'm not
right.
Chinese. I'm Korean.
Right. And there was a really good song that I used to, that I wrote. Well, I thought it was one of my favorite songs, called the Zang Zang Zaga, the Zang Zang.
The
It was just,
dang, that's the one I'm talking about.
Oh,
Zing,
yeah.
Zaga, the ding ding.
Oh, yeah. No, I wasn't playing on it. I was just singing around. I don't know who was playing. No. Bill and those cats were playing, but I wasn't playing because we did that live.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
that was like that. That's that second line, New Orleans second line kind of feel.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, that was, you know where I got that from? Clark Terry doing
Mumbles.
Yeah. When I heard him do Mumbles, it just blew my mind. It's just another great St. Louis cat.
Oh, unbelievable. And an
Phil
incredible,
Woods.
Him and Clark and Phil Woods together. I mean, Clark was such a virtuoso, you know, he was just unbelievable. I saw him, I mean, because he was so much older than me. And he was supposed to be the band director. So it's the band leader for the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. But that Johnny asked him to do it at first, but the network flipped out. They said, we can't have a black man leading the Tonight Show orchestra. So they got Doc Severance.
Is that how that went? Wow.
Yeah, that's how that worked. And,
well, that's too bad, but he was a good guy. And Doc Severance seemed to be a game cat. I mean, you know,
he was great, and he gave credit where credit was due, you know, but they couldn't talk about that. You know, they couldn't really talk. And at that time, you know, people were ambitious and it was the reality, you know, it was just that, that's the ugly side of, you know, racism. It's like, there were not a lot of black studio musicians in New York, you know, I mean, there were few. I think Milt Hinton and George DeVivier, bass players, people like that. But outside of them, there were not, you know, there were no black musicians at the Radio City Music Hall, you know, that orchestra, because at that time they had a full-time, you know, Radio City band. They were, you know, it was just, you know.
Well, you know, the problem with that, the problem is that it puts white musicians on the spot. You know, I've been through this in Philly. You know, I went through all this in Philly. You can't ask someone who's just holding down a chair to give up his chair. I don't care if whoever's behind them, because they got to make a living too.
Yeah.
So it's not, the pie is so small.
Yeah. But when somebody retires, I think that was the point, is like when there's a turnover, there was never a thought that they wouldn't be drawn from a pool of other white musicians. And I think that's, there was never a natural evolution of that kind of employment possibility was never a possibility. And I understand what you're saying. You can't ask a guy who, like, you know, through no consciousness of their own, they didn't go in there and say, well, I'm taking this from somebody who's black. I mean, I think that's part of the problem of equalizing things. How do you do that? That's such a multi-layered problem. How do you
I don't think you equal. I think what you do, that's what I was talking about earlier. You know, when when the government is involved in the subsidies of like the agricultural industry, where they spend billions and billions of dollars so that everyone can get cheap hamburgers at their local hamburger place.
Yeah.
Well, what's $200 million to spread around all these cities to start jazz orchestras in each city with rotating chairs that allows all, you know, some of these middle school players who are excellent players, not good, excellent players, to get a chance to work their chops and play in it for 3 or 4 years. And then after 3 or 4 years, they just cycle them out. If you have an 18-piece band, you can cover the whole city of Baltimore. I mean, you could, you know, in 10 years, everyone who was pretty good in Baltimore could get a chance to play with the Baltimore Jazz Orchestra. I mean, and so we don't have that kind of thinking. I remember when, I can't remember the name guy's name, because I was on the National Associate, whatever it was called, the thing that was above the NEA that gives out the NEA Jazz Master thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave it to Paquito de Rivera. I think he's not the clarinet player from Cuba. I think his name
Paquito de Rivera.
Yeah. Very, he's a wonderful player. So I said to the guy, I said, well, why don't you give him, you know, if you're looking for a clarinet player, what about Don Byron, you know, who's been at it long? And he said, well, we're looking for a Latino. I said to myself, this don't work like, it don't work like that. And so while Paquito's deserving, the fact is there's just not enough pie. So then someone like Wynton has to go around, raise money every year, and go to Coca-Cola, whoever else, you know, to keep his musicians going. That's not really the way to do it. The way to do it is to have a government subsidy of this great art form that we've spread around the world that we support like the Germans do. So it's beyond race. It's, you know, race is used as the baseball bat to make us push at each other. But musicians are rarely the ones that are involved with it. We play the music and that's it. You know, no one goes and checks your, you know, race card when you come in to play.
Well, not usually. Sometimes. Sometimes it does happen, you know.
Well, I mean, I try to keep that out of my look, when I did the corner, they asked me to use a contractor on Broadway whose name I won't say because I don't want to get sued. I heard he died, but I just said, look, he's allergic to black players, so we ain't going to use them.
I know who you're talking about.
Yes, yeah, so I just said we ain't going to use the guy. We'll find somebody else because I want guys I know can do it, and that's it. And so that's how it worked. The problem really is that it's rarely, there's just not enough work, but it's also that when a musician gets older, they get more expensive. And then the band leaders don't want to call these cats. They cost too much. So they want to get a younger player, whatever their race, because these jobs are hard to find. I think the root answer to this is that we have to develop a, you know, bad word, socialist type government.
Absolutely.
That subsidizes. Otherwise, academics are the ones that get all the gigs, and they're not the ones that are out there with their ear on the ground listening to the music. They're just not. You didn't come to New York with a silver spoon in your mouth.
No.
You can't, you know, you started struggling, a young family. And so that made you, you know, that helped make you better. But the new players, if they can't survive, if they can't live in an apartment with 10 people in it, in New York, they're not going to make it. It's just not, it's not possible. So we have to change the vocabulary so that academicians aren't telling jazz players and young players who know how to play nothing but the computer what to do.
Yeah.
Because the computer's an instrument now too.
Yeah, I mean, and it's just, how do you stay true to the music and survive? Because in an environment like New York, I mean, there used to be an old joke, what do you call a guitar player without a girlfriend? Homeless, you know? And it's like, you know, it's like that. That's really the truth. I mean, you got, you know, the couches. I you know, I crashed in Gil Evans' spare bedroom. And then after that, I lived up at another friend's house, crashing on the couch because I couldn't make a living, you know? And then I just, series of accidents happened. And then, you know, one thing led to another. And it's just, you got to hang in there, because I you know, I've been on unemployment often in my life, you know, and you just, you know, for me, it's just like there was never a thought of doing anything else. Why don't you get a real job? And I don't know what that means, you know.
Well, I understand. I mean, I played in Jimmy Scott's band.
Ah.
At the end of his life, you know, there was, when we, it was a Freddie Hubbard's funeral or Jimmy Scott's, I can't remember, one or the other, we would collect money. For, I mean, they were collecting money for these cats. I mean,
yeah.
What kind of society is that when you, where you, the people who create your greatest? Quincy Jones said something one time that was very profound. He said that this is one of the only art forms where you actually, show the merchandise to the person, they experience it, they enjoy it, and then they have to decide whether or not to pay for it. Well, I mean, that means,
and now they don't even have to decide. They can just download it.
Right. Well, that, you know. But there's a, I mean, I think the future of music, if I had to say, you know, is that it's in some form of where the music is played and people actually act out the music. I think that's the only form of like really high paying music that will, unless we get our government, you know, if we have a government after November, you know, no. Hopefully we will, unless we get our government, you know, involved. I mean, because we've got to find a way to support the arts that's better than what we're doing now. This whole business of the MacArthur Fellowship, I mean, and the people who choose it, these academicians, these people who got tenure, been teaching at, you know, some schools, wherever. I mean, deciding who the people, it's just no good. Yeah. It leaves out too many really good players who end up having to starve. It just doesn't work, you know?
Yeah. I was always outside that because I was never the best player. Never. I was in high school band, there were three alto chairs. I was third.
No
I
kidding.
Was probably least likely to succeed. And music, like, forget it. You know, it was like not, you know, just I just did this other thing. I followed this other voice. And there was no logic to it and no plan. I had no plan, nothing. I kept doing it. And then shit just happened to me. And I have no idea why, but I just, you know, the criticism was irrelevant to me because I wasn't after what they thought I was after. I just wanted to be around it. And if I was, you know, third alto, or, you know, I was the backup guy here, I'll take that because I just wanted to be around it, you know?
Well, I think that most musicians, you know, most good musicians or true musicians, or most musicians in general, feel that way. That I think the difference is that there's something that drives players who have a specific, like if you hear George Coleman talk or you hear, I mean, these guys say the same thing. They just want to be around it. They don't care. Yeah. You know, they don't really want to be the best. It's not even about that. It's just that they're just like, it's the honey and they're the bee.
Yeah.
And they're just going back to the comb.
And like you said before, when you were talking about grants and things, and what does it mean to be the best? I mean, how can you even think in those terms? Who's the best trumpet player?
Right.
Based on what? Right. What criteria? The fastest? The
right.
loudest,
right.
I mean, you know, who's the, what's the best novel? The one that sells the best? Well, that becomes the metric,
right.
You know, like sales. Then it's about capitalism. Then it's about product.
Right.
And otherwise it's just, you know, it's in the air that you don't have to, we don't have to decide who's the best. That's why I always hate those polls, downbeat polls.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I mean, in a way the reader's poll is it's a little bit more of a reflection of like who's popular, who do people relate to. And, you know, I mean, there's a little bit of truth to that stuff, but, you know, what?
No, the information systems,
yeah.
If you don't mind my using one of those AI terms, it's what's screwing things up. Because the information system tells us that this person's playing, or she's playing, or he's playing, or she's playing the horn, and he's playing the bass.
Yeah.
On that. And so this is what we have to sort of this becomes it becomes a strategy of getting the music, who can bark the loudest. And then what happens is that bark becomes familiar and people just listen for that bark every time. And then it doesn't allow space. And of course, the flooding the market with junk, you know, also makes it more complicated. What we need is that, and people who distill it, because people don't know, they don't know the, I mean, people don't know the ignorance. You know, it always amazed me when I was touring one time with a band and we go to bookstores and play, I was always amazed at how ignorant people who are literate are with when it comes to music. Like I used to play with this band called the Rock Bottom Remainders. They were
all authors.
Yeah, all authors. I used to call them the reverb band because as soon as they start playing, they said, give me more reverb. I need more reverb, you know.
Covers a multitude of sins.
It was a bad band. I mean, it was all tongue in cheek for them, but it was agony for me because I did really would.
Yeah.
It was tough, man. But people really liked them, man. I mean, people really like, I mean, they were like, oh, they, you know, they're really so good. And even the writers themselves would say, I can't play shit. I can't play. I mean, one time we, you know, what's the name who did Be My, one of the Ronettes.
The Ronettes, yeah. Be My Little Baby.
One of the, she does the Christmas song every year.
Ronnie Spector.
Yeah, Ronnie Spector came and she came and sang with us. And, man, I was saying to myself, man, shit, man, she, I don't know what she's thinking. I hope she's getting paid a lot because this band sounds like shit.
Well, you think they just, people loved them because they were famous.
Yeah. Well, yeah, right. But also, I'm telling you, when I went, at, you know, when I toured one, you know, some years back with a group of pretty good players. And look, when I pick up my horn to play, ain't nobody, ain't, you know, Sonny Rollins and them ain't shivering in their shoes. You know what I mean?
Well, you toured with, you know, when you did a book tour for the Good Lord Bird, you went out with a band.
Yeah, I did went out with a band.
I thought that was brilliant.
But we went out and we would play bookstores and theaters and high schools. And you'd be surprised at how people who are literary know so little about jazz. They know so little about it. I mean, honestly, you know, they don't know who Thelonious Monk is, and they have no idea. They know who Mick Jagger is, and they know who Bruce Springsteen is. And God bless Bruce Springsteen because he does a lot of good stuff with his life.
Yeah.
But they don't know who, you know, Donald Harrison is. And, you know, they don't, you know.
Lester Young or.
No, they don't know. And, I mean, and so when you're playing, it's just that, you know, if you go to Italy, the Italians, even, you know, even the so-called lower class, I mean, even Italians who are like school teachers, they know good opera. If you come in there singing bad opera, they're gonna hoot and holler, get out of here. Yeah. But Americans, I feel like sometimes we don't even know our own music. I mean, when Bruce Hornsby came to Camden 2 or 3 months ago, he came with a band, and I'm telling you, they were kicking ass, man. They were. He had five cats up there, and the audience was like, they were waiting for one of these Generation Z bands to come up there and make a lot of racket.
Yeah,
I was like, you know, I guess, you know.
I don't know. You know, I'm always, when I get into these kinds, you know, talking about this stuff, there's a point at which I go, wait a minute. Am I just the old guys that's saying, you know, bring back mono, bring back the big bands, you know? And there's an element to that. But at the same time, you go the other way, you know, and it's like, okay, it's Frank Sinatra and bell bottoms. You know, it's like, no. Don't just be who you are and present the music in a way that's honest. And at a certain point, people get it or they don't. But you're right about trying to set up situations where the music, you know, the arts, and particularly for our purposes, the music has some kind. You elevate the visibility of a lot of these aspects. I mean, I think, you know, some you know, some when they have musicians on American Masters, you know, right. I think that's always a great thing, because, you know, you can dive into the, you know, history and what Wynton did with Ken Burns, but jazz. I mean, you know, there's a lot of things that are wrong with that, in my opinion. But that was a massive effort to just,
right.
You know, and
It opened the door.
Yeah. I mean, I think they gave short shrift to everything that happened after 1960. Right. But, you know, but be that as it may, you know, the idea of the importance of Louis Armstrong and Duke Ellington and some of these other people, I mean, I think that was, you know, and you know, Wynton brings a lot of eyes to whatever he does, because he's so incredibly talented and so articulate and so passionate and I think argumentative in a very interesting way.
It's when Wynton came on the scene, you know, I got to New York like right around the same time he did, and you know, we both took the music industry by storm. It's just nobody knew my storm, but you know,
it was a squall.
Yeah, right. right. It was the one of those storms where the devil's beating his wife, where it rains and the sun shine at the same time. That's the kind of storm. but what he did was he rescued the music from complete obscurity.
Yes.
And then he became saddled with the responsibility of explaining America's history to itself. And that's something that no one person can do. At a time, there was another writer, the Black Cat, who died.
Stanley Crouch was
a wonderful music critic. But then toward the end of his life, he became, you know, he just changed. And he became, I don't know, he just didn't, he didn't really, he wasn't the Stanley Crouch that I remember when he was younger. It was just a wonderful, became just, I don't know, somewhat bitter and, you know, pedantic. And you know, I just didn't agree with some of the things, some of the approaches that he had in terms of how he viewed music. But I think that we demand too much of the Wynton Marcelluses and the McBrides. I mean, we ask them to explain. We don't ask, you know, the conductor of the New York Philharmonic to tell us about the history of European classical music. I mean, we just give him lots of money to conduct that, and we give lots of money to the people who participate that, and some of it's government and some of it's corporate, and that's the end of it. But we don't do that in a city like Baltimore or Miami or Chicago, Denver, you know, and there are musicians in every one of these cities, deserving musicians of all types, men, women, of all colors. We don't do that. And in not doing that, we do disservice to the other wonderful styles of music, including music by Native Americans. I used to, for years, I worked with a woman named Pura Fay, who she works with the Gittens, whatever her name is, Gittens. Her name is Gittens.
Oh, Rihanna Gittens.
Rihanna Gittens. Yeah, she's
the banjo player.
Yeah. And they do, you know, I mean, Native American music was here before. Really, there is a good argument to be made that a lot of the blues comes from that. And there was, in fact, it was a big, I think it's, I forgot the name of the movie, but it's a, there's a movie about this called Drums. Anyway, we don't make room for that kind of discourse in our society. We're so concerned about the SEC and the NBA and all this other bullshit that the reason why we can't talk to each other, because we haven't learned, we have to teach kids how to listen to music.
Yeah.
We have to teach them how to sit down and listen, because part of my job as a writer is to listen to people. And part of your job as a composer and as a saxophonist is to listen to people. Yeah. And by doing so, it makes you reflect something that we want to hear, or in my case, reflect something that people want to read.
Yeah.
So how do we do that? We create, we get the academics out of it, and we find the Louis Catos and the Marcus Millers and of every city.
Yeah. Yes.
And say, these are the people who are going to form the nucleus of the listening, of the, you know, of the government's subsidy music program the city of Denver. They're not from the University of Denver. They're musicians who've been playing in clubs. You know, they do have a certain level of competency and so forth. And they're going to decide who's going to be in this revolving thing that will touch upon every issue, element of music. I think that would be the substitute for the clubs that you grew up in playing.
Yeah. Places that aren't there anymore.
Places that aren't there
anymore. You know, and right now, the only places that those exist are you know, places that are subsidized by corporations or really rich people. You know, right. there's a program in St. Louis, in my hometown, called Jazz St. Louis, that is underwritten by several very, you know, wealthy and compassionate people who love jazz and have set up something kind of similar to Jazz at Lincoln Center in St. Louis. It's an outreach program to the community to be a place like very much like, I don't know if it's still going on, your community, the mentoring program you have in.
I still do that at my church. Yeah, we still have.
You know, this is on a different scale, but it's basically the same thing. It's a place to go where people can learn how to play music and to learn about the music and to understand and to, you know, have a space to learn and be taught, you know, how to play their instruments and what that means. And even, you know, it's almost a cliche that you say, even if you don't become a musician, you learn very valuable lessons about.
Oh man, if I have a corporation,
math,
I want math, cognitive, you know, cumulative learning. I mean, the reason why I started my program in my church is because we needed an organ player. We couldn't find. I mean, when I was a kid, you could throw a rock and you could reach out into the congregation. There was somebody, two or three people who could play organ. And then we couldn't find anybody. And then you try to find an organ player. And listen, here's the thing. In church, if you're looking for an organ player and you call up some guy and he says he'll do it. And if he ends up by saying, have a blessed day, forget it. You ain't going to see that guy no more. That just have a blessed day, man. Get lost. That falls under the thoughts and prayers category. In other words, I'll see you later. So what are we looking for? Let's develop our own. We've got 10,000 kids here in the projects. And we've been doing it 12 years. We haven't had, you know, tremendous success. We've had three who went to college. You know, we got one teacher out of it. I mean, we got one organist out of it. And, you know, maybe we'll get some more. But my point is, there's no mentoring. I had kids in the projects who never even seen a band play.
Yeah.
Never seen drums, you know, play. They just listening to stuff on the internet, you know. So, and these Broadway shows, you know, they have these programs, you know, and they bring in some kids from Brooklyn and they let them see a Broadway. So then they all want to be actors and actresses. Nobody wants to sit down and play. They all want to be on Broadway.
Yeah, yeah.
That lasts 10 years.
Well,
unless
they want to be stars. And I think that's... that's the thing. I mean, even about music, it's like, you know, if your motivation... And I don't know if there's ever anything you can do about that. But what, you know, what somebody's motivation is. I mean, maybe it's if you get them in the door and then maybe they'll, after time, realize that it's got to be more than that. You know, I know for me, I never wanted to be in front of people because I'm, you know, disabled and I was always sensitive about it. So I'm like in the background. So I never wanted to be the leader. I just ended up being the leader because that's the only way I could get what I was trying to say out. So I became a band leader by accident, not by choice. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but see, you know, the inner thing that pushes you and gets you out of bed every morning is what is the thing that makes you a superbly gifted musician. And there are people in this world, and me too. There's a thing inside me that, you know, all whatever, you know, swilling dissonances I have that live in my soul make me a good writer. But the point is that everybody has that. And so if you're a musician and you have it, then they're usually, and you're playing in a group, there's usually three or four people who have it too. And then you got something to share it with. I think that what we're talking about here is you know, because you played music with at a time when you started playing this music, you were playing with a disaffected people who had
Yeah.
created something that was really cool. And you
Yeah.
just found yourself and you said, you know what, I like this. And you excelled in it because you were disaffected yourself, whatever, however you
Yeah.
want. So we have a youth who are disaffected and they have no way of expressing themselves. They get on the internet and they just do kill themselves, do all kinds of crazy stuff. They have no way of expressing. We have a way to get to them by putting instruments in their hands. And the dream is to make every kid walk around with a clarinet and know who Sidney Bechet is. And
Yeah.
there's no greater, there's nothing that will drive them greater than to try to figure out to get people to say, I'm gonna figure out and show my parents, I want people to know who Sidney Bechet is.
Yeah.
If we can get that into people's heads by, you know, improving our schools and then giving musicians a chance to play. And that's why these corporations, I mean, God bless them,
Yeah.
but we're depending on them. It should be the other way around, that the government should be involved in this.
Yeah,
Anyway,
when you
I
depend
feel
on the
like that.
largesse of Conch Shell Oil or the Rockefeller Foundation or whatever, then then you're subject to the same kind of evaluation in terms that don't really have a direct relevance to what you're actually talking about. And I don't know, I think it's a process. You just have to I mean, you just keep speaking up. You just keep saying, hey, what about this and what about that, and raising your voice, because it's like when you're talking about the government, what can I do and what can you do? We can, I mean, organize, yeah, but at this point in my life, all I can do is when somebody asks me, I tell them what I think, and I can vote, and that's about it, and on whatever metaphysical level that the world operates on, I say, okay. I just send out, an
Well,
immediate
that's all.
offer.
Listen, you have put in your time, man. I mean, you, we do what we can, and that's it. I mean, we
Yeah.
can't, that's for a younger person. That's, you take on
Yeah.
that responsibility. It's better to just show people
Yeah.
what you've done and let them recreate it in their own way. The way that you and I came through, no one's going to be able to do that anyway. I mean, that they're going to come up with a
Yeah,
different
it's a different time now. It's a different context. And
time,
but
different.
all you can do, I mean, and the way you talked about it, and when you talked about In the Color of Water, the stuff that your mother just she was just describing what it was like to be in New York, to be in Harlem in 1941. Just the atmosphere, the energy, and that has to be valued and examined by all of us. It's like we have, what was it like in the 18th, well, read Dickens,
Yeah,
read David Copperfield,
Moby
read
Dick, man. Moby Dick, man.
Dick, yeah, Call Me Ishmael, baby.
Oh man, I
One of
took
the
that.
great opening lines in
Moby
ever.
Dick, yeah, of ever. Absolutely, absolutely.
That's I think one of my there are two books that really I just hold up all the time. It's Huckleberry Finn and Moby Dick. I mean, that's just I can
You
just
got the
read
best.
those and reread them and
You got two of the best. I mean, those two are the best, and they're both, by the way, they're both in first person, which is easy. First person is like trumpet playing. No, first person is like saxophone playing. It's easy to get a sound on a saxophone, but it's hard to sound good. Third person is like trumpet playing. If you can't play the thing, then just forget it, So that's why when people are blogging in first person, I didn't like the food, and the guy was very mean to me. Therefore, don't go eat at that restaurant. Boom. That's first person. The third person is, John walked into the restaurant. He felt he was being treated poorly. Now, oh, wait a minute. Now somebody's got a who's John? But you got a really good. So that's why I don't play the trumpet, man. Hell with the trumpet. That's just it. That's it. But I mean, Call Me Ishmael from Moby Dick is one of my favorite great. And Huck Finn, I've read it many times. I think the last three chapters of Moby Dick are the most exciting chapters of any book that I've ever read. Yeah.
And you read it and reread it, and it you still got that excitement. It's
Yeah,
just
yeah.
that there's that, you know, it's just like it's inevitable, but it's surprising, and it's
Well, you have to remember now, he burns a lot of ink on whales before you get these whole chapters on, you know, whale bones and all this other bullshit. And, you know, so you're like, and but it's he's so well written that you read it anyway. But then when Moby Dick actually shows up, I mean, when you see Jaws, the movie, you say, okay, the composer and the screenwriter read Moby Dick many times.
Oh, yeah.
They got it, and they laid into it, and that's why, you know, Peter Benchley, you know, God bless him, he figured it out.
Yeah.
When the master, it's sort of like, it'd be like me playing tenor, and then Sonny Rollins steps on stage next. You say, oh, I see where he let's kill the first guy for wasting a half hour, and so that, you know. So, but yeah, I love those books, man. I'm like you. If I find a book I like, I just keep reading. I read it again and again.
It's like a great movies. It's
great
like,
movies.
You know, just I want to see them over and over again.
Well,
it's like like Casablanca. It's like
I just saw that. I just saw that. I just I made my class watch that like about a week ago. Great writing.
Great writing. I think Julius Epstein was the kind of the major screenwriter for that. But
was he?
a lot
I
of
don't
stuff,
know who he was. I don't know who he was. He must have been a heavy hitter, though.
Yeah. But I mean, the director, Michael Curtiz, just the way, you know, everything was shot, and, you know, the camera angles and the character actors, the guy Cuddles Sakal, the kind of chubby guy with a big double chins, and what's his name, Colonel, I can't remember, the
guy
German
who played
guy,
the guy who played the police
Claude Rains,
the French guy. He was the French
yeah,
commandant or the German commandant. They were
the
both
German,
good.
yeah. I think it was Conrad Veidt was the actor that played the German guy,
they were excellent.
Oh,
I felt that, you know, though, having come from Berlin recently, because my daughter lives there, I must say, my perspective about Germany has changed quite a bit. Because they seem way ahead of us in terms of their humanity and their ability to get along. And, you know, the depiction of Germans in our media is sometimes skewed to this whole, you know, to what happened in World War II. But going back to that movie, the reason why that movie is so good is because structurally it's put together very well. It sets up first of all, it has a central place. It's set up in this club. Basically, it doesn't leave the club. It goes from one part of the club to the back room and then back to the front. And so it has a couple scenes outside, but essentially it's in the club. It's like a piece of theater, and the dialogue is so pointed. And also there's a lot of ambivalence. You know, the Germans and the French soldiers don't quite, they're supposed to get along, but they don't quite do it. And then they don't quite like each other very much. The competing club, the blue, I forgot the name of it, with the fat
blue
guy.
parrot, Sydney Greenstreet.
Yeah, that's who that was. Wonderful.
Yeah.
The guy who says it's hard to sell about whatever, you never know what he'll do. And the dialogue was just so, in movies, dialogue has to be all, it's got to be all melody, man. No fat. It's got to be all muscle. That's it.
Yeah.
And so the dialogue was just, when I was working with Spike, when we did Miracle at St. Anna, I said, you know, I was writing the script, and he said, have you seen, he said, you need to see Casablanca and see Lawrence of Arabia. So I watched those movies again and again and again. Again and again, I studied the script again and again. It's like, you know, I remember when I was doing a session with Anita Baker, and I wrote a song for her, and I said, what key are we going to, and I'm not a piano player, and I play piano. She said, I want you to play piano. And I said, I don't play piano. She said, I don't care. I said, well, what key do you do in it? She said, I don't know no keys. So I learned it in every key. I learned it in every key. And then I walked into the session, And Kenny Kirkland was sitting there. So I said
Kenny
to him,
Kirkland.
Yeah, Kenny Kirkland was sitting in the, you know, I walked into the session. Barry Eastman was producing the session, and Kenny Kirkland was sitting in the control room. And I said to him, and they were working on something else. They were going to do my song next. I said, Kenny, man, you know, she wants me to play piano on the song, man. I learned it in every key, but I don't, you know, you're here. And Kenny, he said something that was so funny. He said, listen, man, James, just make the money. Make the money, man.
That's funny. Talk about a master musician, Kenny Kirkland. Oh, what a horrible loss that was. I was on the road with him. I had a band I put together. It was him and Al Foster and Charlie Hayden and Don Elias, percussionist.
Wow, man. Was this the swing band? When was this?
No, this was, I did an album called Another Hand, which was kind of an off the wall album. I had done a lot, I've been doing a lot of, I had one album that I did that was called, I don't even remember what it was called, but it was kind of at the end of my run of playing like more, it got a little too pop for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, Marcus, I gotta do something else or I'm gonna go back to using drugs. Because I can't do this anymore because I don't my heart's not in it. I don't believe it anymore. So I did another album and I got guys like Bill Frisell, Jack DeJohnette, Mulgrew Miller, Charlie Hayden, and some other people. I did this album called Another Hand, which is kind of a little bit of a left turn. And I went on a tour and I did some of that music, a lot of other rearrangements of some of my earlier stuff. And Kenny was in that band. And he was like, you know, when guys are really good at what they do, like what you said, they make it easy. But sometimes you don't notice how great they are, how much you're supported by, you know, like it's playing with a great drummer. It's like, I got your back. You know, Steve Gadd is like that. Great drummer. Marcus is like that. It's like, you know, everything is locked in. Everything. Christian McBride is like that because he's got your back. He's going to make what you play right. If it ain't right, he's going to make it right. Please, James, I would love to continue this at some other point.
Let's do it again.
And see what, you know, whenever we pick it up again, we'll see how much the world has changed.